Star Trek composer Jerry Goldsmith.
Well, science fiction films have been something I was always interested in. Going back, I suppose, to my early days in television when I started Twilight Zone and doing those films. I always liked doing those kind of pictures because there was such great imagination going into the stories and the creation of them, and it gave me as a composer a very broad palette, and I could really was free to do with whatever I wanted to do. And I think that as far as me writing in a more avant-garde style for film, I think that culminated in Planet of the Apes, where I could pull out all the stops and do whatever I wanted to do with that film. The director, more interesting and more far out I was going and more experimental, the happier the director was. So I had a free hand in doing that. And then I did, yes, Logan's Run and Alien and what else? I guess a lot of them. And Star Trek, the original Star Trek, the television show, I was asked to do it originally. And this is something that Alexander Courage tells the story. I mean, he reminded me of it, as a matter of fact, one day. That he'd seen the memo that had come from, I guess, Roddenberry to try and engage me for that. But I remember this day, some 30-some-odd years ago, getting this phone call to do it. I was unable to do it because I had a conflict and I was doing something else at the time. So it's rather serendipitous that years and years later that I came back to this project. But I think when it came to Star Trek the Motion Picture, although that I think that George Lucas's visioning of the music for Star Wars greatly influenced, I mean, not so much what John Williams wrote for the music, but I think stylistically the music, rather than being avant-garde and being strange, and he plays is very romantic. And when you stop and think about it, space is a very romantic thought. I mean, it's to me, it's like the Old West, only we're up, you know, in the endless universe, and it's just about discovery and new lives. And then when it came to Star Trek, which is really, I guess, the basic premise of Star Trek, I never really understood all the story, to be perfectly honest, but I do know that it's really about goodness. I mean, it's about a better world is where we can live in peace and tranquility with one another. And it's a lovely thought, and I think that's why the universal appeal of it. And musically, you're going to go that way. And so it was more or less that was what was out there, and that was very successful, but it made sense. Subsequently, I've treated all the Star Trek movies that I've done in this more musically romantic way, rather than getting very avant-garde and making strange noises and all that. It's totally the opposite approach that I had on Planet of the Apes.
This is Doug Trumbull. We are about to do the voiceover for Star Trek the Motion Picture.
This is Robert Wise, and I've started to make some commentary on the film Star Trek the Motion Picture. Doug had supervised the effects for 2001, which were groundbreaking, and then he went on to handle all the graphics for the Andromeda Strain, which I directed in the early 70s. When we discovered that we were going to have problems getting all the effects done on Star Trek, he finally agreed to come in and supervise them. He had just come off of Close Encounters for Steven Spielberg, and he brought all the equipment and the team of people from that show over, so we benefited from a lot of the development work that had been done for that film. John Dykstra worked for Doug back when we did Andromeda Strain, and John went on to do the original Star Wars and the TV series Battlestar Galactica, which he had just finished. Because there were so many shots to do on Star Trek, Doug asked John to take over part of it, and John basically did the Klingon and Epsilon 9 scenes and the exterior of the V'ger spacecraft. Doug handled the Enterprise and the interior of V'ger, but of course their work overlapped quite a bit. The opening shot of the Klingon cruisers was done by John Dykstra at Apogee.
I'm John Dykstra, and I'm sitting here watching Star Trek The Motion Picture. And these will be my recollections. Oh, here we are. It is the fleet coming This was an interesting shot because this was sort of the signature piece that I used to convince Mr. Roddenberry that we could do a big opening for the show. Now, the idea was to be able to do this huge camera move, rotating over the top of the ship and then ending up behind it. Extremely long opening shot. And it was a very difficult shot to do. It took almost 3 weeks of original photography to get the single center ship.
But this is the shot which is redone upside down with the Enterprise at the end of the movie. Just kind of bookends the movie in a philosophical way to match the shot up. Except these guys are not going to go into warp drive. So this is more of your classic Star Wars kind of lighting. And then this interior, which is the set that I designed with John Vallone, this kind of spider leg shock absorber idea, I thought was a lot of fun.
I worked with production designer Harold Michelson, getting it to resemble a World War II submarine. The Klingon sequence is shot at the end of production. The overall shape of the Klingon cruiser is similar to what they had on the original series. The model was built by Magicam. It's a pretty large model, about 6 feet long, so it has a lot of surface detail. We've trimmed a few seconds of the Klingon captain in my director's cut in order to make him a bit more aggressive in attacking the cloud. It seems to be an unprovoked attack, but Gene Roddenberry explained that this is what Klingons would do.
Of course, there was only one Klingon ship, so we had to re-photograph and redress the single ship for three different variations. So you felt as though you were looking at three different ships.
The Klingon captain is played by Mark Leonard. On the original series, he played a Romulan commander, and then he went on to play Spock's father, Sarek. He is the only actor to play all three main Star Trek aliens.
Chum-chuck!
He came back as Sarek in three of the later films and also an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation. This is a communications satellite called Epsilon 9. We have exterior shots that show more of John Daxter's work. We have a miniature figure in a spacesuit that we see a few times throughout the picture. Over this scene, we hear a lot of calm chatter, voices from starships calling the satellite and instructions going back and forth. In there is a reference to Commodore Probert, which came from Andy Probert, who actually wrote all this dialogue. Andy was the main concept artist who designed the Enterprise. He worked with Gene Roddenberry before I came on the project and worked out the refit and design of the ship and exactly where everything was on it. The woman on Epsilon 9 is Michelle Billy, who is the wife of John Polville, the associate producer of the film. John was a tremendous help all the way through the film, especially with getting the script in as good a shape as we could get it. But John was on the project long before I came on. Back when Gene was developing it as a new weekly series, John was working with him and he eventually became the story editor. The show was going to be called Star Trek Phase 2 before Paramount decided that it should be a feature film. But before that, Gene brought in Harold Livingston to be the producer who would oversee all of the scripts for the show, and Michelle Billy was Harold's secretary. And that's how Michelle met John. They're still married and have two young sons. The effect of the bright energy ball coming out of the cloud is what we call the whiplash.
You're just looking at a very bright light, but you're seeing some of Larry Albright's spark effects that were done in big glass vessels with various kinds of gases in them. And then a lot of it is enhanced with animation, single frame animation of lightning effect.
What we wanted to indicate was the ships weren't really being destroyed but digitized, just converted into data patterns by V'ger.
We thought it would just be boring to just blow a model up. I mean that's done over and over and over. You see it a million times. Star Wars did it very successfully. Joe Viscosal is like the kingpin of model explosions. But we just wanted to have something different that was more of a dimensional energy effect rather than an explosive effect.
Now we have Vulcan, Spock's home planet, which was shown once in the original series. And for the director's cut, I've had some of the shots changed. We originally had matte paintings done by Matthew Urosich, but he had almost no time to do them, so he was never quite happy with them. So we started from scratch and took a look at what was already established about Vulcan from the original show. And we had Foundation Imaging generate new digital maps using original live-action plates. In the very first shot of the scene, we see a small figure of Spock, which was shot by a second unit crew out in Yellowstone Park at one of the geyser fields. In the earlier version, you couldn't really make out Spock, so we designed a new shot and moved around the geyser field a bit and did a tilt down from the sky to see Spock kneeling there. The reason for adding the tilt is that both Gene and I felt we didn't really establish the connection between Spock and V'ger strongly enough. So we now, in the director's cut, visually connect the last shot of the cloud to the first shot of Spock to indicate that he's sensing the presence of V'ger. In the second new matte shot, we have a much more dramatic sense of the Vulcan landscape with these giant ancient statues all around as Spock walks up to the Vulcan masters. The closer shots of Spock and Vulcan masters are done in the Paramount lot in what they call the B tank. It's normally a parking lot, but once in a while they fill it with water. They need shots that are supposed to be out at sea. It has a large backdrop painted like the sky. We didn't use that for this scene, but we did set up the large red boot and a bit of landscape down in the B tank for this scene.
I wanted to create with that whole Vulcan scene something absolutely sterile and cold and emotionless. And it was sort of boring to sit and record this stuff. You could kill the orchestra, and I'm going to play Nova Broad and just keep it very, very dead sounding. But dramatically, it works fine, and that was really the approach I went there.
When we shot the scene, the actors spoke their dialogue in English, and we originally planned to show it that way. But then we realized that to have the Vulcans speaking English but not the Klingons was a bit of a cheat. So we brought in a language expert to come up with a Vulcan language, but it had to match the lip-sync on the screen. The problem was that it looked like the Vulcan was matching the English too closely. So Gene suggested that we change the subtitles a bit so that it wasn't such a word-for-word match. So we inverted sentences and changed a few words to make it work. Now we come to the headquarters of Starfleet Command in San Francisco, and again we made some changes to what we had originally. This sequence was storyboarded by Maurice Zubron, who was a longtime collaborator of mine in doing storyboards, and we actually started work on a series of three shots that would show the setup of the Starfleet facility as we followed the air tram into the station. But we had such a crunch that we had to go with just one shot, again a matte shot done by Matt Urosich, but it didn't really present the look at the 23rd century Earth that Gene was hoping to show. The new shots have now been completed by Foundation Imaging, working with live-action plates taken up in San Francisco.
Commander Sonek, you received your appointment as Enterprise Science Officer.
Base time.
This shot was shot on one of the big stages at Paramount.
Captain Decker requested I complete final science briefing here before we leave on our mission.
At Starfleet.
This shot was done by Darren Doctorman, who supervised all the new effects for the director's cut. We did redo the trams and added an upper level to the station. If you look very carefully, you can see a Starfleet shuttlecraft from the original series.
Report to you, sir.
It is my intention.
We originally had another Urosich painting that he didn't like very much, although parts of his painting are still in the shot.
This is the sequence where Entertainment Effects Group comes into play. This is a Matthew Urosich Earth painting, and this is a miniature that was built by the Able crew that we then kind of rebuilt and relit and repainted a little bit. But these are the kind of moves. You'll see that whenever you get closer and closer to the Enterprise or some spacecraft, the camera will actually decelerate. And this was a technique that just helps give a sense of greater mass rather than letting it naturally kind of accelerate as it gets near the edge of the frame. We would do just the opposite. And these slow kinds of movements, I think, tend to have a lot of massive gravity to them and more natural motion than
zooming around all too fast.
I think Dykstra did the transporter effect. Yeah, I didn't have anything to do with them.
Transporter effect, first of all, we used Lissajou patterns. This was, again, a laser application. In other words, we took the laser and refracted it through broken glass. Literally, we used crystal. We buy expensive candy dishes and shatter them, and then mount the little pieces of crystal on a little motion control mover, and then shine the laser through that piece of crystal and re-photograph the patterns that they presented on a wall. And those are called Lissajou patterns. And for the transporter effect, we used a combination of that, which was sort of the surround, with another, what we call a slot gag, which was basically more of the same two-dimensional artwork, where a moiré pattern was created by moving one pattern against another and then re-photographing that. It was two-dimensional. It was a two-dimensional effect that looked three-dimensional because of the convention of the way the moiré looked.
Now we come to the sequence where Scotty shows Kirk the new Enterprise. It's a fairly long effects shot, and I guess some people have strong feelings about that, but I think that Jerry Goldsmith wrote such a perfect piece of music for it that it works just fine. A lot of ideas came into planning this whole scene out. First of all, Gene had a very limited budget on the television show, and the effects were just barely passable for what they were doing. Yet people grew to love the Enterprise, but perhaps because you could tell that the characters did too, particularly Kirk and Scotty. So when it came to the movie, Gene really wanted to finally show the Enterprise the way the fans wanted to see it. He wanted it to look big and real. He also had strong feelings about what the future would look like. He wanted the Enterprise scene to show us what we believe could be a reality.
Any man who could manage such a feat, I would not dare to disappoint.
The travel pod was maybe a model about 12 inches long, not very large, with lights inside. But it also had a rear projection screen inside it of a 35mm lock-off film shot of the principals from different angles, side angles and front angles. So that on the various shots that where you see action inside the pod, it's a rear projected movie. But we could also do two passes where you'd have the rear projected movie, the pod is moving or the camera's moving relative to the pod, and you could actually see the light, the angle of the lights inside the pod shift because we'd have a second exposure of those lights. You just have to be careful because it becomes a superimposure. And you would see the light, actually. There's one of the shots where you'll see a superimposure of the interior lights over Scotty's face. Well, this was fun because the dry dock provided a kind of a mask so that you don't reveal the Enterprise all too much. And it takes the trip all the way around to the front before you really get a full-on shot, and that's when the big music cue kicks in. So this kind of obscures it, but it, you know, kind of teases you a little bit.
One reason I felt it was important, later in the film, we need to feel really humbled by the sight of V'ger. So by showing the Enterprise like this, we could really establish just how big the V'ger vessel is.
So you can see the little vehicle that just went by. Each of these shots is a series of elements. The travel pod going away, the travel pod coming toward you, the space station in the distance, the sky, the stars. There's almost all these shots are six or seven layers deep of sandwiched, optically sandwiched elements.
The other element of this scene is Doug Trumbull's concept for visual effects. He really wants the effects to be as much a part of the story as anything else. And to do that, they have to be believable. You have to be able to keep them on the screen for a period of time. In this scene, the illusion of the Enterprise in dry dock is sustained for 5 minutes, and this is what Trumbull was going for. He also has a concept for first-person cinema, where you can set up a story, a location, and just spell out the characters and have the visuals and the music surround the viewer. Trumbull wants the audience to become the characters in the story, and the challenge is to do that for 5 minutes using miniatures and effects. That's what he wanted for this scene, and I believe he achieved it.
Again, you see the perspective shift there, but right at the end of that shot, you'll see the light over Scotty's head a little bit. This is one of the few shots in the movie that was a blue screen shot, a live action blue screen shot in 35 millimeter of the foreground. We tended to shy away from those because we didn't like the quality we were getting. When you get, you know, you've got a shot now of Captain Kirk, but then you're going to see what he sees. This is what I like, which is what I call first person cinema, where you're no longer looking over the shoulder of an actor, you kind of become what he sees. And I think that's a more immersive cinematic experience for the audience to actually be able to see this shot, have it not all cut up into various cuts. This shot may last any number of seconds long. And you really get a chance to just kind of be him and be there and look at it and enjoy the view and not have it interrupted with a lot of melodramatic dialogue. So every chance I get to do something like this, I like to milk it for as long as we can make it work. This was one of the astronaut stuntmen that we had mounted on a post, so he could actually move his arms and legs and seemed to be a little more weightless than the miniature rubber astronaut miniature guys. Again, I like all these lens flares. Sometimes we actually went to the trouble of actually putting tiny bits of tin foil in the gate of the camera so that even lights that were not in the frame would create a flash into the frame, or like a light that's entering and exiting the frame, you see that flash. That just adds another layer of realism and naturalism.
Thank you, Mr. Scott.
Aye, sir. Permission to come aboard.
When we arrive on the Enterprise, we start to get a sense for what's going on with Kirk. He obviously pulls some strings to get command of the Enterprise, and now that he's here, he finds it to be quite different from what he remembers. This allows us, or allows the viewer, to have someone on screen seeing the new Enterprise for the first time as we do.
Aye, sir.
It really wouldn't have worked if Kirk seemed at home on the ship. A little while later, he actually gets lost. So it's nice that it seems unfamiliar to him, because it's certainly unfamiliar to the audiences at this point who've only seen the original TV episodes. The first establishing shot of the bridge is the first piece we shot on the movie. We actually had the entire cast there that day, even the ones not in the scene, and I can remember suddenly realizing that this was something truly historic. Here on the bridge, we see some of the characters for the first time, Uhura, Sulu, and Chekhov. Kirk comes in, and after he leaves, there's a little moment with these characters. I originally cut this out, and now I put it back in because it helped us realize that these characters really do know what's going on with Kirk. They worked under him for several years, and they know him.
Epsilon 9 is monitoring the intruder. Keep a channel open.
I see.
Where's Captain Decker?
He's in engineering, sir. He doesn't know.
And what's happening is that this is basically Kirk's midlife crisis. He's trying to recapture his youth because he sees the world just sort of passing him by. And he feels that if he comes back to the Enterprise, he can avoid that.
He wanted her back. He got her.
And Captain Decker?
He's been with this ship every minute of her refitting.
Ensign, the possibilities of our returning from this mission in one piece may have just doubled.
The design for the inside of the Enterprise came from a combination of a lot of artists. Matt Jeffries designed the original Enterprise for the show, and certainly components remain in design for the film. Mike Miner, who also worked on the original show, did paintings for several of the sets, including the bridge and sickbay. His work was just spectacular. Andy Probert worked on a lot of the concepts of the Enterprise refit, exactly what would be changed and how, and where everything was located on the ship. Zuby, Maurice Zuberano, also did some paintings as well as a lot of storyboards for the entire film. My production designer, Harold Michelson, worked from all of these sketches and, of course, did many of his own, and he brought some of his own ideas into it as well. He wanted to create the impression that gravity had somehow been conquered in the 23rd century, so objects might not seem to be supported in any traditional way, but nevertheless they were. He also wanted the Enterprise to have a strong vertical feeling, so that you'd get a sense of the different levels of the ship. He was hoping to actually have the floor somewhat transparent, so that you could actually see activity below, but that was far too complicated to work out. But we did get the multi-level effect in the engineering room, with some clear floors on the levels surrounding the main engine shaft. The effect inside the shaft was developed by two guys named Nicholson and Longbottom. The process was called reduction kinetic lighting because it created these wonderfully swirling light patterns that you could have going while we were filming. We all felt this really helped create the sense of a new but powerful energy source for the Enterprise.
That's why you're staying aboard.
Stephen Collins plays Will Decker. He was the only main actor I was involved in casting. Even Persis Kabata, who plays Ilea, was signed before I came on. She was going to be a regular on the new series until they decided to do the film. We needed to have somebody for the new character Decker, and I interviewed a lot of people, and one among them was Steve Collins, and I liked Steve so very much and felt he fit the character description of Decker, so I signed him for the part.
Aye, sir.
Transporter is malfunctioning. What we did was, to create the transporter malfunction, we had the outer surround, which was the Lissajou patterns, is produced by our argon laser refracted through a candy dish. We had the what we call the slot gag, the little dots of light inside that are hue to the shape of the character that's meant to be inside the transporter. And that was done as a two-dimensional effect with filtration and light flares. We have the actual actor's images, which we distorted using our Mylar gag. Essentially what it was a flat Mylar sheet, which worked as a perfect optical mirror when left flat. But then when you distorted the surface, created these very unusual optical distortions. So we re-photographed the actors in their normal form through this mirror and did motion control distortion of the mirror to create the distortion of their image as presented in the malfunctioning transporter.
Starfleet, do you have them?
Enterprise, what we got back didn't live.
With the transporter room accident, we set up why we needed a new navigator and science officer because they unfortunately perished in this terrible mishap.
Starfleet, Kirk.
The Vulcan is, of course, Sonak, who spoke to Kirk earlier in the tram station, as told to report to the Enterprise.
Commander Sonak can be reached through the Vulcan Embassy.
The transporter chief, Janice Rand, is played by Grace Lee Whitney, who was Captain Kirk's personal yeoman during the first season of the original series. I felt that the transporter malfunction would help heighten the tension that we feel before the Enterprise gets underway.
Gentlemen, turbo shaft 8.
Back that way, sir.
We have to replace Commander Sonak. I'd still like a Vulcan there, if possible.
None available, Captain. In fact, there's no one who's fully rated on this design.
You are, Mr. Decker.
The original series told us that the Enterprise has a crew of 430, so we felt we should take advantage of the opportunity to show them all, so we have the crew briefing scene. And this is actually important to Kirk's character, because they obviously have a lot of advanced technology. Instead, he takes the time to assemble them all on the recreation deck and shows them some vulnerability. This is all in keeping with Gene's vision that the greater our technology becomes, the more we need actual human contact with each other. The wrecked deck scene was shot fairly early on, and most of the people in it were Star Trek fans whom we recruited from one of the conventions. Ordinarily, you get extras to the Screen Extras Guild, but they couldn't supply enough rough sound that day, so we got a waiver from them and brought in some fans, outfitted them, and made them crew of the Enterprise. My wife, Millicent, is in the front row. And elsewhere, we have Grace Lee Whitney's son dressed as a Vulcan. Also in the crowd is Susan Sackett, Gene's secretary at the time, and B. Joe Trimble, the fan who started a letter-writing campaign in the late 60s, which convinced NBC to renew the show for a third year. Also in the scene are some alien characters. We had extensive costume tests for a dozen or more alien species, but I was never quite happy with how they looked. They just weren't convincing for a big film, so I tried to obscure them a bit and show them sparingly. We did trim some dialogue from this scene for the director's cut. It had to do with Kirk assuming that there was a vessel inside the cloud. I feel it's stronger to let Epsilon 9 make that theory and then have Spock confirm it later on. When we see the transmission from Epsilon 9, we see an actor named David Coutrou, who we saw earlier. David was going to play a Vulcan character named Zahn when the second TV series was being planned. But it was abortive, of course, so when I came on, I was glad that we found a part for him in the film as Commander Brench. David was friends with Michelle Billy, because they were in the same acting troupe together, as was Edna Glover, who plays the Vulcan priestess.
Apogee built this model and shot this model.
This was about a 6-foot long model, and it was an interesting technique that we used to create it. We used acid-etched brass. And the reason we used this acid-etching technique was that it gave us very square edges. And square edges, in fact, are a dead giveaway on miniatures. If they're not square, if they're round, then you get the sense that the scale of the miniature is not what it's being presented as. The V'ger Cloud is basically two-dimensional artwork that is moved one surface against another to create the moiré effect, and that's what gives the animation to the light that you see inside that huge cloud.
Pre-launch countdown will commence in 40 minutes.
Back on the bridge now, we're about to meet the new navigator, Ilia, played by Persis Kambada. As I said earlier, she was already cast when I came on the picture.
Aye, sir. Transporter personnel reports the navigator, Lieutenant Ilia. She's already aboard and en route to the bridge, sir. She's Delton, Captain.
Persis was Indian, and there was a big trauma about shaving her hair. She knew she had to do it, and she was very upset about it. And I went over to the makeup department when they were doing that, and then she had this beautiful long black hair. And when they were cut it down, they were shaving her head. She was almost in tears, losing her hair. But she went back to India and unfortunately died, 1998, back in India.
My oath of celibacy is on record, Captain. May I assume my duties?
By all means.
Jean had this whole idea of the Deltons who were hairless. And their planet was, where sex was almost like a handshake. So that's why Uhura is cursed and mourning about it, and why Ilia confirms that her oath of celibacy is on record.
Helen?
Yes, sir?
What was the problem down there?
He insisted we go first, sir. Said something about first seeing how it scrambled our molecules.
Now I put back in a short scene of Kirk arriving in the transporter room, because I like the humor in it, because I really wanted to give the three main characters a really theatrical entrance, especially Spock later on. All through the original series, McCoy voices his like for the transporter, and so I thought that, plus seeing him looking very much retired, was a lot of fun.
Well, for a man who swore he'd never return to Starfleet...
Just a moment, Captain, sir. I'll explain what happened. Your revered Admiral Nagura invoked the little-known, seldom-used reserve activation clause. In simpler language, Captain, they drafted me.
They didn't.
This was your idea. This was your idea, wasn't it?
Bones is a thing out there.
Why is any object we don't understand always called a thing?
Headed this way. I need you. Damn it, Bones. I need you. Badly.
Permission to come aboard?
Permission granted, sir.
Well, Jim, I hear Chapel's an MD now. Well, I'm going to need a top nurse, not a doctor who'll argue every little diagnosis with me. And they probably redesigned the whole sick bay, too. I know engineers, they love to change things.
Now we finally get underway. The Enterprise is a model that's about 8 feet long. I insisted that we have a big model so that we would have no limit to what kind of shots we could get, and I didn't want it to look like television. Unfortunately, Doug Trumbull would have preferred it even bigger, but he still made it work marvelously. It didn't have a single bad angle on it.
Dock control reports ready, sir.
Helm ready, sir.
Orbit and departure on plot, sir. Yard command signaling clear, sir.
Maneuvering thrusters, Mr. Silva.
Maneuvering thrusters, sir.
Hold station.
Thrusters at station keeping, sir.
As we pulled out, we hear Jerry's wonderful theme. I should point out that he actually started recording music before he came up with that theme. They did 5 or 6 cues in the late September 79, and we viewed them against the picture, and they just didn't seem to work. This cue, pulling on a dry dock, was one of them. The low theme was pretty much in place, but the main theme was still undeveloped. So I called a few people down to hear the music and played it for them. Everyone agreed that it didn't work, even though it was beautiful music. So I had to tell Jerry. Fortunately, we were breaking for a month from scoring while we got more effects done, so that time Jerry hit upon the theme, and when they came back at the end of October, he recorded new versions of those cues.
We made a rig of a kind of a body harness on a pipe that could be rotated and photographed a stuntman against a blue screen so he could flip and tumble and do real live motions. We were disappointed with the fact that the little model astronaut didn't have enough natural physical motion. It looked too rigid. The same problem came up in the Spock spacewalk sequence where he looked a little bit too rigid.
When we put the director's cut together, by the way, we went back to the original music scoring tapes and remixed them digitally, so it just sounds as good as it can be. The entire film was remixed, by the way, mainly because we didn't even have time to do a proper sound mix on it. We had a lot of sound designers working, and a lot of effects were recorded, but there was really no time to get them into the picture because by the time we locked the cut, we had to make the prints. And so a lot of the original version of the picture, we had almost no sound work done on it. Now we've gone back to all of that original material and have given it a new mix, and it really comes alive, I think.
Impulse power at your discretion.
Thank goodness we had Jerry's score in there. I remember telling him that the music would have to take the place of sound effects in a lot of places, and he really saved us.
When you do what is often done, like if you use Star Wars as an example, or even 2001, if you assume that a spaceship is kind of in the solar system, the sun is there somewhere, so you've got a key light, and you fake in some fill light, which would not really be there in reality, to give you a key to fill ratio of something to light up your models. And I said, well, in this movie, we're nowhere in the solar system. There is no sun. And the source of illumination, I think, has to be the Enterprise itself. If you go to LAX, you'll see airplanes where there's lights lighting up the fuselage, lighting up the logo of TWA or Pan Am or whoever's on the tail of the plane. And I thought, well, if we kind of created a lighting direction inside the ship that justifies it lighting itself up, so that you could shoot from any angle in any direction and never have to justify a key or a fill, that already solved a lot of problems. So we kind of gutted it, relit it, repainted it, but used the basic ship that had been built. And we did the same thing for the dry dock and all the other ships to make them more usable. I think I would have built them at a little larger scale than they did. It would have been much more comfortable shooting. We had to commission a special periscope lens system in order to get the lens close enough to the model to get the angles we wanted. So the periscope was about 3 feet out in front of the lens to kind of sneak in under the nacelle or between the wings or whatever and get the angles. We wanted to have enough lights on board the ship to where it would look like it could light itself up. You'd have a little light coming out of the fuselage shining up on the wing that was supporting this nacelle that was the thruster with lights inside those. But once we had justified it with a few little lights shining on itself, then we felt we could, well, we'll put about 10 times as many little flecks of light as though there are sources of light which are completely fake. But we came up with a very simple technique with Dave Stewart, who was, and Richard Yersich, who were really the keys to the photography of the whole thing, and Dave being in charge of the miniature photography, of just shining one big light into a big cluster of little dental mirrors, little mirrors about an inch in diameter on a little swivel, and you could just take that one light and turn it into 50. And so it gave all these little flecks, which gave it scale, because there's no one big light. There should be hundreds of small lights. And that's what really made it all look bigger than it was.
Now we have the wonderful effect of going to warp speed and then followed by the wormhole sequence. This sequence alone took 9 months to complete and a long time to shoot.
This wormhole effect was a very sophisticated effect of a scanning laser beam on a rear projection screen, accumulating over several minutes per frame while the camera moves in and out on the screen to create this tunnel. So it's actually a kind of a swirly scan effect that's been turned into a kind of a slit scan effect. And then the interiors were all supervised by Bob Swarth, who did this incredibly meticulous rotoscoping of the live actors, pulling off little masks and creating these streak exposures, this kind of pulsed streak off of key highlights, or highlights off people's faces, or highlights off of blinking lights, and then continuing to exaggerate the effect as the sequence moves on. It was a very, very difficult, challenging thing to put together and fit to the live action and then recomposite it. And particularly hard to do when the camera's moving dynamically like this.
The wormhole actually came from Isaac Asimov, who was one of the science consultants on the picture. And Gene was fascinated by problems that had to be worked out to travel through space faster than light speed.
The Enterprise was shot normally, and then Bob Swarth would take high contrast traveling mats off just the highlights and the lights on board and blur those on the animation stand with a kind of a streaking process. Every shot has been processed. I think it was a very successful effect.
Stephen Collins. The whole wormhole sequence took 3 weeks to shoot. Now, in 3 weeks, we can shoot, you know, a whole television movie. It's about a three-minute scene, and it had, I think, 40 or 50 camera setups. But every time we did every camera setup, it had to be done four different ways. It had to be done, then it had to be done in slow motion. Then that camera had to be moved out, and they brought in an ancient 65-millimeter camera, which gave them a bigger lens to work with on which to draw the special effects. And then we had to do a 65-millimeter slow motion. So, you know, normally when you finish a scene and you get it and the director says, print, you're done with that setup. Well, in that sequence, you were one quarter done. Because then they'd do it in slow motion and you'd have to do as many takes as it took to get the print, and then they'd bring in the 65-millimeter and you'd have to do as many takes as it took to get the print, and then they'd do the 65-millimeter slow motion, and by the end of that setup, you just wanted to... I mean, it was like root canal. It was really hard.
The only problem was that the big finish of the scene, the explosion of this asteroid, was not quite the climax we wanted, so now we've completed the shot we originally designed.
This is the photon torpedo, and we had access to a 20-watt argon laser, which at the time was, it was sort of a beta device. There weren't that many of them around. It required a huge power supply to run it, and it required a huge supply of water to keep the power supplies cool. And we operated that, 24 hours a day for about 3 months to make the photon torpedoes for both the material from the Klingon ship as well as the photon torpedoes or the the weaponry on the V'ger.
I think the whole wormhole scene was maybe 3 pages of the script. So we were literally dealing with maybe 2 lines a day. Or, you know, we're just doing today Chekhov's reaction in that direction over his shoulder. We might just get the slow motion 65 millimeter shot. And that would be it for the day. And it was excruciating to go that slowly. But that's what it takes to do. Now they could do it a little bit more easily, but I don't know how much. And it was exciting to see it when it was done. God. But I've never been through working at a pace like that.
Level 5.
Harold Michelson had the idea for this large translucent door. Dick Klein then thought it would be great to use it to reflect their entrance from the hallway. They didn't plan this together at all, but it's just one of those things that worked out.
When they went into antimatter imbalance, the phasers were automatically cut off.
And you acted properly, of course.
Thank you, sir. I'm sorry if I embarrassed you.
In this scene, we finally get to the root of what's going on with Kirk. He feels threatened by the younger guy who knows more about the ship than he does himself. McCoy suspects this and goes along to see what's going to happen.
Permission to speak freely, sir?
Granted.
Sir, you haven't logged a single star hour in 2.5 years. That plus your unfamiliarity with the ship's redesign, in my opinion, sir, seriously jeopardizes this mission.
I trust you will. Nursemaid me through these difficulties, Mr.?
Yes, sir, I'll do that.
Then I won't keep you from your duties any longer, Commander. Yes, Doctor.
Aye, sir.
You may be right, Jim.
In working on the director's cut, I discovered why we really needed to emphasize Decker and Ilea a bit more. Both Steve and Persis are marvelous actors, and both roles really could have been hammed up, but there's a marvelous restraint of believability to them.
Well, that you didn't even say goodbye.
If I had seen you again, would you have been able to say it?
No.
Make your point, Doctor.
The point, Captain, is that it's you who's competing. You ram getting this command on Starfleet's throat. You've used this emergency to get the Enterprise back.
And I intend to keep her, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Now McCoy lays it on the line to Kirk. You've used this emergency to get the Enterprise back and you plan to keep her. It's an obsession. McCoy knows that Kirk is somehow unfulfilled, that he thinks that having the Enterprise will solve all of his problems.
Bridge to Captain.
Viewer on.
Well, the nick of time comes a message that a Vulcan shuttle is approaching.
She wishes to come alongside and lock on.
The images of Uhura and Chekhov on the screen here were filmed separately and are rear projected on the Kirk's quarters set.
I suspect it is a courier of some kind.
Very well, Mr. Chekhov. See to it. Viewer off. Your opinion has been noted. Anything further?
That depends on you.
This whole area of the film is very interesting to me as I look back at it now, starting with McCoy's exit and the closing of that smoked, translucent door. Kirk is a very dark character in the first part of the film, and this shot, I think, is very symbolic of that. As I said earlier, I wanted to give Spock a very theatrical entrance, especially since he was the favorite character of a lot of people, and it was no secret that there was a question of whether or not he would be in the film. So rather than just beam him into the transporter room, we designed this sequence where the Vulcan shuttle actually locks onto the Enterprise and delivers Spock, and he has this great dramatic entrance. Again, Jerry's music here is wonderful, and this was another cue that he had to redo. He came up with this theme for Spock, which is kind of primitive and exotic. It worked wonderfully well.
Security scan. One more. Identity, Starfleet inactive.
Permission to come aboard, sir.
Granted, sir. Granted.
Now Spock comes on the bridge and we see Kirk light up immediately.
Why, it's Mr. Spock. Spock.
Commander, if I may.
There's a great contrast here of all the characters reacting very emotionally, and yet Spock is not even fazed by this in the slightest.
I've been monitoring your communications with Starfleet Command, Captain. I'm aware of your engine design difficulties. I offer my services as science officer. With all due respect, Commander.
If our exec has no objections?
Of course not. I'm well aware of Mr. Spock's qualifications.
Mr. Chekov. Log Mr. Spock's Starfleet Commission reactivated. List him as science officer. Both effective immediately.
Mr. Spock.
Well, so help me, I'm actually pleased to see you.
Now McCoy comes in with Dr. Chapel, who's played by Majel Barrett, Gene Roddenberry's wife. I really wanted to have a build-up to the emotional reunion, but then hit you with Spock's lack of emotion.
It's how we all feel, Mr. Spock.
Captain. With your permission, I will now discuss these fuel equations with the engineer.
Mr. Spock, welcome aboard.
Hopefully. He seemed even colder than usual because it had to be clear to McCoy and Kirk that something deeper might be going on with Spock.
When I was asked to do the movie, I said, I'd love to do it, but one condition, I don't want to be saddled with the television theme. And I said, this is fine. There's not going to be any association. I mean, well, how can you do a Star Trek the motion picture with William Shatner and Leonard Nimoy and all the cast and everybody else and not be associated with the television show? You can get away from it. That's where it came from. And subsequently, we didn't. There is one quote of the original Star Trek theme under the captain's log, which they finally said, we've got to have it somewhere in the picture. And so I had Alexander Courage actually do it himself, which was the right way to go. Subsequently, in all the other Star Treks that I've done, the four other films I've done, I always start the film with the Sandy Courage fanfare from the television series, which I think is right to do, and then go into the theme that I wrote.
So now we have Spock assisting Scotty with the warp engines, and we have a wonderful scene where they get the Enterprise up to warp 7. I've always seen the Enterprise as a character in Star Trek, and the way this sequence plays, it almost seems that the Enterprise is happy now that Spock is here. Everybody's back now, so everything works right. In the officer's lounge scene, we have a conversation between Kirk, Spock, and McCoy where they got caught up, and Spock starts telling them about the intruder presence he senses.
Spock, you haven't changed a bit. You're just as warm and sociable as ever.
Nor have you, Doctor, as your continued predilection for irrelevancy demonstrates.
Gentlemen.
He describes it as having perfect thought patterns and wants to seek it out for that reason. This set was not nearly as elaborate as what was designed. Andy Probert did a wonderful drawing that allows that a big panoramic window where you could see the warp engines. What we ended up with is a rather small room, which sewn together fairly quickly. I think Harold Michelson had to upholster boxes for some of the furniture.
There's also a discipline you broke to join us. Will you please sit down?
We have a small window there which had blue screen on it, and we always intended to show the aft part of the ship in some way, but again, there wasn't time. We felt on the original series we never got a sense of the connection between the exterior and interior of the ship, so we wanted to establish that relationship for the first time. We've now gone back and added in the starboard nacelle to the window for the long shots of the scene.
Hold my answers. Well, isn't it lucky for you that we just happen to be heading your way? Bones. We need him. I need him.
Then my presence is to our mutual advantage.
Any thought patterns you might sense, whether they appear to affect you personally or not, I expect immediately reported.
Of course, Captain. Is there anything else?
No.
The stars in the window are relatively easy because you can rotoscope the live action. We have nothing but trouble with these blue screen shots, which was one of the reasons we didn't put nacelles in there. Because it's easy to have people against stars because you can get away with murder, but when you have some actual object that they're against, you always tend to see them outlined.
But he wouldn't put his own interests ahead of the ship's. I could never believe that. How do we know about any of this?
Bridge to officer's lounge. Captain Kirk, revised estimate on cloud visual contact, 3.7 minutes.
On my way.
Now the Enterprise is encountering the cloud, and we hear more of Jerry's wonderful score.
Standard light engineer.
You can hear his use of the blaster beam, which he found for V'ger.
They had a music at Paramount. Said, there's this guy who's got this thing called a beam. Let's go over and listen to it. And I listened to this thing, and what it was is it's about a 12-foot long piece of aluminum with strings on it, metal strings strung the whole way over it, and then amplifiers under each string. You play it by hitting it with an artillery shell. And then you'd pump up the low end on the mixing console. And it made rather an incredible noise. And it was quite musical, too, because as you moved this shell, it was like a steel guitar player plays with this metal bar, the same process. You just move that shell around, and then you hit it different ways, and you can hit the shell, you hit it with a timpani mallet. So it's rather some interesting sounds. I got sort of intrigued with it. So I said, well, you know, I'll use that for the sound of V'ger. And Bob loved it.
Jerry always looks for interesting sounds and non-traditional instruments to add to the usual symphony orchestra. There are a lot of them in his score for Star Trek, all kinds of percussion, water phones, rumble boards, tune logs. He really created a unique sound for the picture. When I did The Day the Earth Stood Still in the early 50s, Bernard Herrmann used the theremin on the score, and it sort of became associated with that film and with science fiction in general. I think the same thing happened with the blaster beam in this film.
Background here is actually black and white lithograph negatives, the V'ger cloud, as we called it, and that was Doug's concept, and that was moiré patterns of light that moved against one another to create the V'ger cloud.
Spock.
It was kind of a multiplane technique. I had a huge sheet of glass, about 12 feet wide and about 5 feet high, that I would paint these abstracted cloud shapes on, and it was on a track so that this left side of the glass was hinged and not moving, and the right side of the glass could be incremented around in a circle. And then I would shoot with a view camera, 4x5 view camera, and take multiple shots over and over and over as this glass was incremented, like 1 inches or 2 inches or 3 inches, from exposure to exposure of the same airbrushed artwork. So you could set up shots from different angles, obliquely or straight on or from the side or whatever, and create these kind of three-dimensional curved cloud layers.
This is the V'ger weapon, whatever it is, and it's a combination of a little bit of photon torpedo, part of the rays of light you see moving out, and the way we created the electrical discharge was we photographed a Tesla coil. We actually made a Tesla coil that was, I can't remember, it was 1.5 million volts, something like that. At any rate, we were photographing this system very close to the Van Nuys Airport, and we got complaints from the airport people that our electrical discharge was interrupting their radio transmissions. So we had to build a wire cage around the Tesla coil in order to eliminate this spillover into radio frequency. And we, as I said, we photographed around the clock, so we'd have crews on the Tesla coil all night long, and there was a certain legend that somehow if you worked on the Tesla coil crew for more than about 2 weeks, it started doing things to your mind. I don't know whether that's true or not, but, well, I don't know. But actually, considering the people who worked on the Tesla coil crew, it probably is true.
I really wanted to have the scene where Aaliyah relieves Chekhov's pain, so we went and found the shots to show her running over. And I think it emphasizes Aaliyah's compassion, which might have something to do with why V'ger snatches her away out later on.
Captain. The intruder has been attempting to communicate. Frequency, more than 1 million.
Now we have another bit, the smack of the film, where Spock actually plays the alien transmission and explains that it's so short it couldn't be detected.
Computers transmit lingua code at their frequency and rate of speed. Commander?
Again, this is the V'ger cloud, and this was multiple elements of high contrast photography moving against one another.
Cloud elements were created by us as still photographs and given to Apogee to be photographed by them and composited. So it was not a 65 millimeter, it would have been still photograph elements of the cloud, which Apogee would then put together and shoot.
And then as the cloud fires again, and we have this very humorous scene where Spock seems to be taking his time, we've completed a new exterior shot that shows the whiplash bolt suddenly disappearing.
There was a huge number of people working on Star Trek, and because of the short turnaround to produce the shots on the show, we asked people to do a lot of multiple duty. We had people who were working in the optical department who would actually go out when time was slow, or things were slow for them in the optical department, would go out and run the Tesla coil camera. And we had a producer who was working during the day doing scheduling and budget work, who would come in at night and work with the Tesla coil crew sometimes. So the Tesla coil had its attractions. It would throw a 6-foot arc in a helium environment. That wasn't like a neon tube, that was just helium inside a plastic tube. So it would jump 6 feet through the air, or through the helium.
I sense no emotion.
Now we have a discussion that wasn't in the original version, where Spock explains that this intelligence is highly advanced, that he only senses pure logic, the very thing he was seeking for himself at the start of the film.
Holding present position, sir.
We also start to get a sense of Decker's frustration. First, Kirk takes away his command, then Spock comes in and takes over the science station. Now Kirk seems to cross-examine everything he says. Decker is obviously starting to feel like a fifth wheel, which will help lead him to the choice he makes at the end of the film.
That thing is 20 hours away from Earth. We know nothing about.
Now we enter the cloud and are treated to many beautiful effects shot by Doug Trumbull's group.
Moving into that cloud at this time is an unwarranted gamble.
And when we come through the cloud, we switch to Daxter's shots of the V'ger vessel. Daxter then did all the shots of the Enterprise examining the surface of the ship. We had no clue what any of this was going to look like when we shot the principal photography. So what we did for these sequences was plan out the reaction shots numerically, so that each number had a different level of interactive lighting. The effects people then designed their shots to correspond. The flight through the cloud and the trip over the Leger vessel have both been trimmed significantly for the director's cut. The original version did go on too long.
I love the fact that there was long, long lines and long scenes with no sound effects to speak of, and just you could just play for a long period of a piece of music. So many films, you get started with something, uh-oh, you got to switch, and something happened, or you cut to another scene, and so you're constantly doing this weaving, you're doing more math than writing, just figuring out how many bars you can get here before you got to switch to something else. You never get to really flow as a composer, but when you have these long scenes, it becomes really fun. You're sort of really composing again. So that was one of the fun things about doing this film, is you had these long scenes with just music, and you have to worry about sound effects. The only regret was, yeah, I wish I had more time. But then on the other hand, maybe I would have had more time, who knows. It was all meant to be the way it was, and it came out fine.
Yeah, this sequence I'm really most happy with, because it has this multiplane, diaphanous, positive, negative, some areas dark, some areas light. And so it has real mass to it, although it's very soft and gentle, and I think it's very beautiful. Allison Yerkes and a team of animators did thousands and thousands of layers of airbrushed artwork, white airbrush on black paper, some of it used as positive masks, some as negative masks, to create this dark, diaphanous murkiness to it. I think it's great. These veils of color and light, I think, are really nice. And we just tried to have as many different variation so that every shot didn't look the same. You would go through layer after layer after layer. Some of them are curved, some are toroidal, some of them are flat, some of them are rotating. It's a really pretty shot. But it was inspired by scenes in a movie called Universe, made by the Canadian Film Board in the mid-50s in black and white, that we had studied during the making of 2001. Galaxies and stars in space. And by making it using similar techniques, but having all these very strange symmetries really give a very weird feeling of distortion and warped space. This final layer was designed to be the transitional layer to get from the EEG effects into the apogee effects, and to become this six-sided symmetry that would reveal the six-sided symmetry of Sid Mead's V'ger, which it does. So there was purpose to it. Okay, so that shot ended and gave you room for a transition from our unit to the apogee unit. So now here you're in the apogee unit. So there is somewhat of a change to the nature of the clouds and the style of the clouds.
Doug shot the cloud stuff that had big dimensional changes in it because it was a slot gag that he'd conceived of, and we composited it with this, which is our back end of the V'ger model. Now you got to remember, when we were shooting the back end of the V'ger model, that was the first part we had completed. When we were shooting the back end of the V'ger model, through the curtain on the other side, outside of the smoke, was a whole crew of people who were building the model. So as you're looking at this end here, there's people on the other side of the curtain who are busy building components of the model. And this was, literally, we took Sid Mead's illustration verbatim and created this image of V'ger as part light source, part organic material, part seed pod. It was a real potpourri of shapes, and it was a real potpourri of techniques. We gasoline etched styrofoam for part of it. We used string that had been dipped in resin for part of it. We created a celastic mold with a very sophisticated celastic mold to cast the resin components that had to be backlit. We used a pantograph device to create layers of plexiglass which overlaid one another to create the canyons in Viger's surface. So again, we're approaching the back end of Viger. We used the smoke to create aerial perspective, so you got a sense of scale as if we were seeing this thing at a great distance. The last shot of the little tiny Viger, or excuse me, the little tiny Enterprise was, I believe, a still photograph of the Enterprise. As we go over the top here, I believe this might be the shot where we used the miniature. And as you see, we're revealing a laser cloud from over the top of this Viger environment, which was meant to be a force field that surrounds it. And the laser cloud essentially was smoke in a room with a laser scanned through it. And these exposures, in some cases, would take as long as 1 minute per frame based on the level of illumination that we achieved. We couldn't change the numerical f-stop, the size of the hole through which the light was traveling through the lens, because it would change the image size. So we had to vary our camera exposure time as opposed to varying the f-stop. All of the pieces that you see here were generally photographed as separate elements. The laser cloud on one pass, the white light that you see emitting from the interior of the Viger on another pass, the blue light that's reflecting off on the surface of the surface on another pass, the smoke layer could be yet another pass. So in most cases, it was 6 or 7 components put together to create the final composite. So we could control how much smoke density, we could control how bright the interior of the Viger was. And that's true of basically all of the material you see here. The idea was to have Viger have a very organic quality, and a lot of reveals, a lot of textures, a lot of open voids through which light could pass, to give this thing a sense of being almost a planet with a, like the Earth, a hot central core. The other theme here was that Viger has a huge electrical field attached to it. And as you see, the electrical discharge was a definite component of its makeup. One of the things I would have loved to have changed is to make the electrical discharge that appeared in the voids of Viger be much brighter and have more of a flaring quality to it. We were having to do that with rear projection. We simply couldn't get enough light into the plate. That's something that I would have loved to have improved. One of the things we used as reference, oddly enough, was fjords with snow on their surfaces and organic, almost geological contours to give this thing a sense of scale. There's the Viger balls, and they're glowing from, they're glowing inside, and of course they were separately lit. This is meant to be the intellect of the of this thing, if you will, or at least the visual intellect. As you can see, the laser cloud is more active near the front of the Viger than it was at the back. And here we come around to make our transition into the interior. And these wheels were actually quite clever. They were a cone that had been cut on one side so that as they roll, they start out in a closed position with all of the edges of them lined up. As they roll open, it actually creates an iris, and that's the iris through which the ship traveled.
Now when the probe comes onto the bridge, we have the new exterior shot. Explain what the probe is. As it comes towards the Enterprise, it looks something like the Whiplash boat, but it stops and sends an energy beam onto the bridge. The point is that the intruder examines the bridge and sends in a probe that is roughly the size of the life forms on board the Enterprise. Then it takes Aaliyah and the same probe reappears in her form. This was a very complicated scene to complete.
The light being was actually an electrician who was wearing a pair of sunglasses, who was prominently photographed in all of the scenes in which this light being on the bridge exists. What we did was used a variation on the distortion the Mylar distortion effect that we used when we had the malfunction in the transporter room to remove the electrician in his sunglasses and the light source, which is affecting our actors. What we added back in is, again, another slot gag, a moiré pattern photographed as a two-dimensional object on a an animation stand, but because of its motion and because of the design of the patterns, it took on a three-dimensional quality. We then animated in electrical discharge, which were in some cases components that were taken from the Tesla coil material that were simply composited in. One of the things that I would have loved to have done, had been more time, was to have much more interactive lighting from the electrical discharge on the actors and on the set. That's a pretty obvious faux pas there. For as much light as those arcs are putting out, one would think you'd see some detail in those surfaces.
We did originally shoot an extra moment where two security guards come on at the bridge and one of them is zapped away by the probe.
This is how I define unwarranted.
We cut this mainly because we had to explain his disappearance at the end of the film, and it was much more dramatic to have only Decker and Ilea be reported missing at the end.
Activate auxiliary computer circuits through manual shutoff.
Here comes the. This is the iris of V'ger opening up. You're going to see the surfaces. Again, this was brass that had been etched to create these organic patterns, and it's pretty interesting because it opens almost like the petals of a flower.
Now we have the Enterprise being drawn into the V'ger maw by a tractor beam, and we continue with Dykstra's effects showing the V'ger vessel. A new navigator comes on the bridge, played by Marcy Lafferty, who was William Shatner's wife at the time.
DeFalco, disengage engine navigation relays now.
Aye, sir.
Force field circuits E10 through 14 show ready for reactivation. Confirm, please.
The thing that's interesting about this was we were doing really sophisticated shape utilization, design utilization in this model, and this was before computers, so we were actually physically having to make these surfaces. These things, the hole that you see there on the screen is probably, I don't know, it's probably 18 inches across in the original model. But the wheels actually had to be made to rotate in synchronization, had to carry their own light sources inside of them. The interior of the ship had to be matted in on a separate pass, and the smoke had to be added as both an overlay over the foreground, both elements complete, as well as a separate element inside the ship to give it even more volume and distance.
Break free to work, Commander. Any show of resistance would be futile, Captain.
We don't know that, Mr. Spock. Why are you opposed to trying?
And this is a composite where we did our laser cloud outside as an element, the surfaces over which the ship are traveling as a separate element, and the ship itself, which was shot on Doug's facility on 65mm that was composited with our VistaVision stuff. This is in the interior. This particular interior shot was done in Doug's facility. Now, in this case, I think we have an interior which was shot on Doug's stage and the exterior which was shot on our stage, and we composited the two pieces together. Exterior meaning the surfaces that are moving by close to the ship were shot on our stage, and the blue sort of distant stuff that's inside was shot as a component on Bug's stage.
You'll notice that the overall design of Feature is hexagonal, as a six-sided design all the way through. This came from Sid Mead, who did all the designs for the Feature vessel. He's a marvelously talented artist and futurist who also worked on Blade Runner with Doug Trumbull for Ridley Scott.
Well, there was a similar six-sided motif that we used in the Andromeda Strain. The Andromeda Strain was based upon a set of nesting truncated tetrahedron geometries, and it became a six-sided object. But, you know, Sid did come up with the original designs for the inside of this, which we had to then physically execute with plexiglass and plywood.
I think that what we did was we started out with sketches. Sid came in with a bunch of relatively simple sketches, and they selected the six-point motif as something that they felt would be appropriate to the creation of this character, because that's what it was in the story, as a character in its own right. The things that were interesting to me is that, well, Ron Resch is conceptual designer. He was a school guy. He came from academia. And Sid Mead was a futurist, and he came from the automotive industry, although he is known for his futurist designs. And the two of them got together, one guy who's very much pragmatic. Ron was very much into how do we make simple forms that can contain space, create environments, enclosed environments. And Sid, of course, was completely from the other side. His deal was, it doesn't matter whether it's practical or not, what looks cool. So it was kind of an interesting marriage of the two. And, you know, Ron was a designer. He liked his stuff to look good, but he was much more based on the physical side of things. And Sid, who also understands the physical side of things, was much more based on the conceptual image side of things.
Greg, Jean, and a whole team of people just... they came up with some very clever techniques for taking these very large flat planar surfaces and building a model out of clay and then indenting into the clay a lot of textures that then they could replicate multiple times in a negative mold and then use the negative of that in multiple copies and replicate it all around in a circle, because the whole project of trying to do what looks like a lot of work and a lot of miniatures as quickly as we possibly could required coming up with techniques to replicate and repeat parts as often as we could.
Now the probe appears in the form of Ilea. This is a sonic shower in Ilea's own quarters. The probe has a synthesized voice, which was done by Alan Howarth.
You are the Kirk unit. You will listen to me. I've been programmed by Feature to observe and record normal functions of the carbon-based unit infesting USS Enterprise.
Jim, what's going on?
Tricorder. Who is V'ger?
V'ger is that which programmed me.
Is V'ger the name of the captain of the alien vessel?
Jim, this is a mechanism.
A probe, Captain. No doubt a sensor-transceiver combination, recording everything we say and do.
And we also gave Persis the transceiver light. Well, we didn't have tiny watch batteries in those days, so that transceiver actually has thin wires going around Persis' neck, which are attached to a battery pack that she's wearing.
Humans, Ensign Perez, us.
Why does V'ger travel to the third planet of the solar system directly ahead?
To find the Creator.
Find the Creator? Who's...
The wires had to be covered up with makeup very carefully. She also wore this very short robe, as you can see, and we also still had her bald head to deal with, so it had to be shaved every day, and then made up because it did get a 5 o'clock shadow. It was also very reflective of a certain light. So for the scenes where she's the probe, it was very complicated for Persis.
I'm ready to commence my observations.
Doctor, a thorough examination of this probe might provide some insight into those who manufactured it and how to deal with them.
Fine. Let's get her to sick bay.
I'm programmed to observe and record only the normal functioning of the carbon-based units.
The examination is a normal function.
You may proceed.
In the sick bay, we have screen projections done by Lee Cole, who also did all the monitors on the bridge. We also have an interesting examination table designed by Harold Michelson.
And molecule-sized multiprocessor chips.
Harold worked with me earlier in the 70s on a film I made called Two People.
Osmotic micropump, right here. And even the smallest body functions are exactly duplicated. Every exocrine system is the same, too. Even eye moisture.
Dick.
Fascinating. Not Decker unit. Gentlemen. Well. What happened to her? Captain, this probe may be our key to the aliens.
Probe? Ilea?
Exactly. It is a program mechanism, Commander. Its body duplicates our navigator in precise detail. Suppose that beneath its programming, the real Ilea's memory patterns are duplicated with equal precision.
They had a pattern to follow.
Indeed. They may have followed it too precisely.
Ilea's memory? Her feelings of loyalty? Obedience? Friendship? Might all be there.
You did have a relationship with Lieutenant Ilea, Commander.
That probe in another form is what killed Ilea.
Commander. Will.
You'll see a lot of shots in the film done with slit-focus diopters, which allow you to get multiple focal points in the same frame. My cinematographer, Dick Klein, introduced this to me when he shot the Andromeda Strain for me, and subsequently insisted on having it for some shots on the Hindenburg.
The Decker unit can assist you with much greater efficiency. Carry on with your assignment, Mr. Decker.
Aye, sir.
I am concerned with that being our only source of information, Captain.
And again, you get into an interesting situation where the entire miniature here is lighting itself up. There's no key light, no fill light, nothing. This is really very much like the mothership in Close Encounters. Just using a lot of smoke and letting the smoke diffuse the light to where the shapes in the foreground are revealed against the shapes in the background, and you get a nice dimensional effect.
Again, we have rear projections, so we dolly back inside Kirk's quarters. On the rec deck set, we have these transparencies of all the different vessels called Enterprise, which I thought was a great touch for that set. Also, I saw 23rd Century Games, which Decker shows to the probe to try to release by Ilea's memory patterns.
What types of recreation does the crew aboard your vessel enjoy?
The words recreation and enjoy have no meaning to my programming.
Ilea enjoyed this game. She nearly always won.
Good. He's using audio-visual association.
Thank you.
This device serves no purpose. Why does Enterprise require the presence of carbon units?
Enterprise would be unable to function without carbon units.
In this part of the scene, we have some shots of Dunn standing against the window with a blue screen in it. We never had time to do the V'ger exterior in it, so at the last minute, MGM Labs just striped some black in place of the blue for us, and that's what went out in 1979. Now we've finally been able to complete these shots.
Within you are the memory patterns of a certain carbon unit. If I can help you to revive those patterns, understand our functions better.
That is logical. You may proceed.
I remember Lieutenant Ilea once mentioning she wore that.
In the scene in Ilea's quarters, I made some changes to include Christine putting the headband on Ilea's head and a couple of additional close-ups just to make the scene a bit more intimate. I think Steve Collins plays this very well. He's very much affected by the apparent surfacing of the real Ilea, but he restrains the performance brilliantly.
Help us make direct contact with V'ger.
We did shoot some additional material at the end of the scene, which was in the television version, but it's much more dramatic, ending the scene with Ilea removing the headband.
V'ger does not know.
In the additional dialogue, the probe asks, why have two carbon units entered V'ger? That's because the script called for Kirk to follow Spock outside and the two of them explore the interior of V'ger. They come up on the memory wall and gather information that tells them that V'ger is a living machine. It's a long scene, about 12 pages of script, and we did shoot most of it. Kirk getting a spacesuit exiting the ship was cut into the television version, but all that did was slow the film down more. The rest of the scene was done on this long set that looked like a canyon, and Spock and Kirk floated around in wires poking into various sections of the memory wall. At one point, Kirk becomes covered with these tiny probes, and Spock saves him. When we were shooting all this, Doug Trumbull was consulting on a picture. They hadn't yet turned all the work over to him, and he came to me and said that the whole scene would be scrapped because it was dreadfully slow and just didn't look very good. And he then said he could come up with something much better, and I told him to go ahead. So he again went for his whole concept of first-person cinema, so Trumbull did all of that and wrote all of the dialogue. He brought Robert McCall on board to do some conceptual paintings for it, which were just fantastic, and Trumbull based his effects on them.
A thruster suit is reported missing.
A thruster suit? That's Spock. Damn him. Bring him back here. No, wait.
He managed to come up with a scene that was really spectacular and yet a very personal moment for the Spock character. Once again, the finishing touch of Jerry Goldsmith's amazing music for the sequence.
You know, again, even in this interior, obviously the Enterprise is shot at a completely separate location. It's a completely different scale miniature from the interior. So the Enterprise had to be optically matted into the V'ger interior. And then these reflections in Spock's helmet were photographed with fisheye lenses in the miniature and then superimposed over his face. And then this is a little miniature rubber man, which I think looks a little fake. And again, this is the orifice designed by Ron Resch, which is a set of six nesting cones that rotate off from the side. You can see the points of the cones are offset. As it rotates, it irises open in a three-dimensional way. And then these are, that ring that you're seeing behind Spock is just one ring photographed over and over and over. So we only had to build one model, photograph it every 6 or 8 or 10 inches, and repeat it. And that would give us a dimensional looking space. And this happened several times in the sequence where we're just trying to milk as much as we possibly can. This is a white plexiglass dome with a flat painting projected onto it with a projector. The painting was made by a friend of mine named Don Moore, who subcontracted this illustration of this alien planet surface. I still have this painting. It's really amazingly intricate. Now we're into some of Bob McCall's weird abstractions, continuing with this V'ger theme of kind of static discharge electrical buildups and tunnels and corridors. And this again, this is one model shot over and over and over and over to create this corridor. So that corridor was very simple to make and very quick. It's just multiple exposures. The space lips, and that's a painting by Bob McCall in the background. It was actually, he kind of elaborated on his own storyboard drawings and made the background painting for that. And weird symmetrical planets arranged in a very odd way. I really like this sequence because it's so strangely abstract. Again, we repeat these rings with more lights so it looks a little bit different with a different background. And this is what I was talking about for stars that now become abstracted. This might be a kind of an effect you would use if you wanted to make a different version of what it's like to be in warp drive, where stars are no longer look like literal stars. They've become something else.
The sensor must contain some special meaning. I must try to mind meld with it.
Again, we did a little over, we overworked the reflection in the helmet, so it just looks a little fake and too bright and too blue. Doesn't quite match the scene, but you can see how these cones are rotating to create this opening. And it looks really interestingly and organic. Here's where Star Trek the Motion Picture meets 2001 A Space Odyssey. Little bumping there on Nimoy. The rig wasn't quite smooth enough.
Spock! Spock! Spock!
When I came on the film, they were actually shooting the memory wall sequence and just really having a hard time because there wasn't any breakthrough visual concept of what the memory wall or what any of that was going to look like. And there was a lot of footage and many, many days, I don't know, were spent on the stage with everybody hanging from wires in the most boring looking sets. And this went on and on and on. I could just see that this was going to be a really boring, slow sequence that just wasn't going anywhere. And I said, Bob, I really suggest that you just gut this stuff. I mean, it's really hard to choke on throwing away days of shooting as well as hundreds of thousands of dollars of sets and all your actors and everything, but I think it's really not going to work. I can't save it for you. I can dump all the visual effects in the world onto the sequence, but I can't save the fact that it's slow and they look like they're hanging on wires. And I think we got to go for a whole other look. And so Bob said, well, fine, let's try something else. And that's when we kind of got together with Bob McCall and started collaborating on this sequence that I felt should be very abstract. It should become way beyond literal reality. It wasn't just a memory wall per se. It was a very big conceptual thing of like compressing the whole universe into some warp drive, compressed, multidimensional, layered, abstract thing that would also be fast and kind of exciting rather than slow and plodding. It was also a way to do some quick and dirty photography and get that sequence over with as quickly as we could. And Bob McCall came up with these wild illustrations of these abstracted, multi-layer, multi-planar kind of universes. And we kind of took his illustrations and built quick models and photographed them quickly. And, you know, it was easier to do because it basically, it's all on center, traveling forward, traveling forward, traveling forward. You didn't have to have cuts to the side, cuts down. You know, there wasn't too many cutaways. And we got Leonard Nimoy to come back and do the reverses in the suit and kind of lock off shots so that we could superimpose the reflections in his helmet, which I'm not too happy with anymore, but it was a good idea. So, you know, it came together. It made a kind of an exciting trip sequence out of what was a plotting, a more melodramatic sequence.
Kirk here.
A faint signal from Starfleet, sir. Intruder cloud has been located on the outer monitors for the past 27 minutes. Cloud dissipating rapidly as it approaches.
Starfleet reports forward velocity is slowed to subwarp speed. We are 3 minutes from Earth orbit.
I'll be right there. I need Spock on the bridge.
Dalphi Link, 5 cc's.
One problem with the film as it ended up being released was that V'ger threatening Earth is not as clear or as frightening as it should be. One of the reasons is that all of the effect shots for this area of the picture were never completed. In particular, having the cloud dissipate and revealing the entire V'ger vessel was something that was sketched and painted about 50 different ways, but we were never able to get a shot of it. Now we have a wonderful shot from the Foundation showing V'ger approaching Earth, and new shots of the huge V'ger bombs being fired going into orbit around the planet. They were all based on the original sketches and storyboards.
V'ger signals the creator.
Part of the problem, I think, is it seemed like any time we showed the entire V'ger vessel, it looked small, and we simply had no time to work out a solution. The whole issue actually came up again as we were designing the new shot. We actually had to make several attempts at it before it looked right. The movement, the lightning, the cloud dissipating, the position of the Earth, these all affected the perception of the size of the ship.
Jim, V'ger expects an answer.
I think it was worth all the work on it. We have quite an effective shot there now.
The creator has not responded.
One problem we had originally was that the V'ger vessel was never built in one piece, so we actually didn't have a model to shoot for the reveal shot. Our new shots were done with a computer model of V'ger, but we also took a lot of care to make sure that it looked like a model and that it was in keeping with what we would have done at the time.
I don't think that we ever showed V'ger as a whole for a couple of reasons. One is that by the time we got to the point where we were photographing the front of the ship, the back end of the ship was being reconfigured for this shooting stuff. And one of the things I wanted to do, although we never did it, it was made out of so many different kinds of organic material. It was covered with oil because we put it in this smoke environment, which was basically made out of oil, and we put oil on its surfaces to give it a sheen. But the model itself deteriorated over the time that we photographed it. And so at the end of the day, V'ger really was coming apart. We were basically kind of pasting it back together to do photography on it. And my whole thing was, what I had hoped to do was to take the V'ger model and as it deteriorated and take it out into Santa Monica Bay and basically just float it out into the channel there and see what would happen when somebody found it as to what they would think it was, because it has a very sea creature-like quality to it.
Carbon units are not an infestation. They are a natural function of the Creator's planet. They are living things.
They are not true life forms. Only the Creator and other similar life forms are true.
Some life forms. Jim, V'ger's saying its Creator is a machine.
Captain. V'ger is a child. I suggest you treat her as such.
A child?
Yes, Captain, a child. Evolving, learning, searching, instinctively needing.
Needing what? Spock, this child is about to wipe out every living thing on Earth. Now, what do you suggest we do? Spank it.
When I finished my work, it was a big relief, but I was completely exhausted, and I went into the hospital. I had ulcers. I had a hiatal hernia. I had high blood pressure. I had everything. I was completely wasted. And so I was in the hospital for, I think, a week or two. I can't remember how long it was. And still feeling pretty lousy when I got out. But by the time I got out of the hospital, the movie was just about to open. And there were a couple last-minute scoring sessions. And I always loved scoring sessions. And so I went over to the stage with, and Bob and Jerry Goldsmith were there. And there were a couple of sequences of the film that were rescored. You know, once all the effects came in, everybody realized, oh, my God, we need bigger music to make this look right. And that was really very gratifying because it was the visual effects kind of prompted a higher level of musical extravagance that really lifted the movie. So I was very gratified and very proud of the movie at the time. It was fun to go to the premiere and do Star Trek. You know, from the very beginning, the whole idea of making a Star Trek feature film was very fraught. The studio, you know, which had had years of doing the series, they didn't know if this was a good idea at all. And I remember at least a couple of years went by with projects starting, stopping, tests being shot, abandoned, writers writing screenplay, abandoned, directors coming on, abandoned. And it wasn't until quite a bit of experimentation and a lot of money and time went by that this movie and with Bob Wise kind of coalesced and got a green light. But I think that there was trepidation about it from the get-go right up until opening night as to whether this was a good idea or it was going to be a colossal mistake to try to upgrade this, you know, melodramatic, low-budget television series that looked pretty crummy in this visual effects area. So to upgrade it to a movie was not a sure thing.
Because V'ger's going to destroy all the carbon units on the third planet.
They have repressed the Creator.
The information will not be disclosed.
V'ger needs the information.
Then V'ger must withdraw all the orbiting devices.
V'ger will comply if the carbon units will disclose the information.
It was a wild concept for a movie that was a big thing to swallow as an audience because it was not like your normal action chase thriller movie. It was some really far out conceptual stuff about, you know, thinking machines and the universe and how far can you go, how much can you know, where is mankind going after this, what's the next step. You know, those are all big ideas. Those are 2001 kind of ideas that were quite a big step beyond the trouble with tribbles, you know.
The other area where effects had to be abandoned is in the Enterprise's journey through the orifice and through the V'ger brain complex. We were told that this material would probably not be finished in time, so we pulled out a lot of dialogue that was to play over this journey. Among these scenes were the moment when Kirk finds Spock weeping. He's sympathizing with V'ger's sense of emptiness and suggests that being back on the Enterprise, Spock himself is now fulfilled. We had one version of the scene in the script and another version that Leonard wrote himself, which was actually much better.
What's the next move?
It's terribly important because Spock explains what this story is all about. So we now have a new film, but originally couldn't have it at all because we just didn't have the effects to cover that length of time. The reason was that the finished effect shot didn't come in until very close to the end. So what we did was ask Doug and John to give us a number of how long all of these shots would run. Now, we did have an agreement with the studio that the film would be no more than 130 minutes long. That was because Paramount had pre-sold the film to theaters in exchange for a guaranteed date and a running time that would allow for 5 shows a day. So we took the number that Dykstra and Drummel gave us and pulled out a lot of dialogue scenes so that we'd still come in at 130 minutes. Most of the money was being spent on effects, and we felt at the time that we had to get as many of them into the film as we could. So we made the list and cut the film with slugs for the effects, and when they came in, we just dropped them into place. What should have happened next was for all of us to sit down and watch it and evaluate the effects work, decide what to shorten and what dialogue scenes to put back in. Then we'd have taken the film out for previews to get an audience response and then perhaps do a little more cutting. The problem here was that when the effects came in, it was so late that we had no choice but to have them scored and then have the lab make the print. All of this happened in the first week of December, and the first print went on the plane with me to Washington, D.C. for the premiere at the Smithsonian, and that was the end of that.
We'll take the intruder with us.
Gene and I talked briefly about doing some more work on it, but the studio was against it because they thought that might suggest a lack of confidence in it. We relied so much on the opticals because they were so expensive, we had no way of realizing that without having a preview.
18 minutes to device activation, sir.
I've directed 40 films, and Star Trek was the only one I didn't have the preview on.
Starfleet has been apprised of our situation, Captain.
I think we know what a preview on this would have told us. Tighten the obstacles and emphasize the characters more. So that's what I've tried to do in the director's cut.
Character beam remains constant.
It's a lot tighter, more focused, and I think the best it can be within the restrictions of what the film is.
As I would for a brother. As I was when I came aboard. So is Leader now. Empty, incomplete, and searching. Logic and knowledge are not enough.
Spock, are you saying that you found what you needed, but Leader hasn't?
What would Leader need to fulfill itself?
Each of us, at some time in our lives, turns to someone, a father, a brother, a god, and asks, why am I here? What was I meant to be? V'ger hopes to touch its creator, to find its answers.
Is this all that I am? Is there nothing more?
Captain.
So what we ended up with was the orifice opening, and we immediately see the brain complex and a flat surface of six-sided tiles leading up to it, and the Enterprise just sort of poses up to it. What we now have is what was originally designed, a black interior of the orifices, and then a distant point of light, which actually becomes a floating island with white lights swirling around it. These lights form the six-sided tiles outward from the island, like the arms of a spider forming a wing so that our people can walk from the Enterprise to the brain island. So now we have all the shots on the view screen of the island approaching. And we have one new exterior showing the Enterprise traveling through the chamber inside the orifice.
V'ger,
when we were doing the whole thing of, you know, going into V'ger at the end. It gave us insight into what silent movies were like, because in a silent film, the director could talk to the actors the whole time, because there's no sound. Well, Bob would do that in some of these sequences, because they knew that the sound would all be changed, and there'd be music, and we weren't talking. So he would talk us through it, and we'd be looking at an X, you know, on a light stand. Somebody would just tape an X like that, look there, and someone might be moving it around so that our eye line would change. And Bob would be saying, you're looking, and you're looking. It's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen. You've never seen anything like it. And all of a sudden it moves, it opens, and it's colorful. There's colors, there's every color of the rainbow. You know, he would just talk like that for 10 minutes, and you'd just react as though you were seeing any of that, when in fact all we were doing was seeing an X on the light stand. That's actors, I guess, were paid to have imaginations, but there was a lot of imagining there. And it was amazing to then see the movie and see, finally, what we were looking at, none of which we saw when we were making the movie.
And then we have our completely redesigned wing walk sequence, starting with a new establishing shot that shows the wings continuing to form. Then we have the principals coming up onto the saucer section. In the original film, we had a terrible shot here where the Enterprise looked completely out of alignment. Then we have the completion of the wing using the original 65mm live-action plate. For this shot and the next shot, we went back to the original blue screen elements of the people. We have one close-up and then a new single angle, which we didn't get to complete originally. Again, we use the original blue screen elements of the action. And then we get to the Brain Island and see V'ger. V'ger, of course, turns out to be Voyager 6, a probe launched from the Earth centuries earlier, and we actually had NASA and people from JPL consulting us on it. The set that the Voyager is in was designed by Harold Michelson. He described it as a hubcap. It's an elevated set that was very hard to walk on, and a couple of times some crew people actually fell through the floor of the set. We also had Nicholson and Longbottom's lighting effects going there. And through this whole sequence, we have a series of changes in the lighting that were planned out very carefully by Dick Klein.
V-G-E-R. V'ger.
National Aeronautics and Space Administration. Jim. This was launched more than 300 years ago.
Voyager series. Designed to collect data and transmit it back to Earth.
This is one area where I think our original sound work was pretty good. I think you really get a sense that this is a very complex, powerful machine that it is alive. Gradually we start to build visually towards Zecker's decision, and I think it's a very interesting one. What we have is a machine that has gathered all the knowledge in the universe, but it can't do anything with it. And the original script climax was that the Voyager would download all of its information. But John Polville came to me and said, Bob, what will all that look like visually? I didn't have an answer, and John presented this whole idea of Voyager coming back to capture its creator so that it would evolve. I really liked that idea, and so did Gene, so we went with it, and even though the few of the studio didn't really seem to understand it. Steve Collins really loved the idea, and it made perfect sense to me.
Machine inhabitants found it to be one.
Strangely enough, that was probably the clearest thing to me. There's a kind of leap of faith involved in that, which they talk about in the scene, that just made sense to me. The idea that we want to leave our human selves and go on to something bigger, even if it might mean leaving everything we have behind. If someone came up to you and said, you have a chance to save the universe, it will require you giving up your human form, but you will actually become something greater than a human form. You'll have all the things you have as a human, all the feelings and emotion and ability to reason, but you'll also be able to fly and move at the speed of light and be omnipresent. A lot of people would go on that trip, I think. And I don't even know if I would now, because I have a family now. I might not want to leave them. But I got it then, and I had just started meditating at that time. And there was something about the process of meditation that made me feel like I was released from my human body a little bit. So there was something about the idea of being released from my human body. I don't know, there was just a spiritual element to it that made sense to me, and I really didn't want to talk about it much or discuss it. And that was the part when I read the script that I thought, ooh, that's going to be the most fun part to play. That I get. I don't know if I know what it's like to go toe-to-toe with another guy in the military, but I get that part about kicking it all and, becoming this fabulous new life form. I think almost all of us have this thought from time to time, wouldn't it be interesting if we could just chuck our lives and go to something totally different? We don't do it almost ever, most of us, but Decker gets to do it, and there's something really inviting about that. I love that part of it.
The film itself was sort of the rallying point for a huge number of people, and I think if the film had more pre-production time, we obviously would have done the work that we did with smaller crews. We brought together, and I can't remember exactly, I believe there were 150 people at our facility working on the visual effects for Star Trek, and probably a comparable number at Doug's place. And the thing that was interesting to me was that we managed to do the work in a collaborative way without much in terms of hard copy. It was mostly conversation between individuals. And we managed to communicate what was going on visually, verbally, as opposed to having to send a set of blueprints or data or stuff that really became an exhibit as opposed to a concept. And I think that the pace of the production required all those people to be, I don't know what the word is exactly, intuitive about what they did. And although there's some flaws in the work, in terms of the time that we had to do the work, I think that it's pretty smart, for the most part. The things that were conceived of are pretty elegant in the way they fit into the story, especially considering that there was no concept for many of these images until well after the live action had been completed. Now, as far as I'm concerned, to say any individual or any individual group of people who worked on this film was better or worse than any other group of people is kind of tough. I guess if there's any thanks to be given, it's to Bob Wise, who sort of had the faith to give the work to Doug and to us to bring to life this thing in this very short period of time. It must have been very painful for him to have to move as quickly as he had to move. And I thank him for the opportunity to work on the picture. And I must thank Doug, because Doug is the one that brought myself and the other people onto the show. Richard Juricich is all of the people that that worked on the picture at Apogee lived this for 6 to 8 months. And I guess, you know, it's one of those deals where you go, you know who you are. There's too many people to mention a few names and not conspicuously leave out others. So it was a bit of a war, and I guess we're all veterans of that of that saga.
Its knowledge has reached the limits of this universe, and it must evolve. What it requires of its God, Doctor, is the answer to its question: is there nothing more? What more?
They needed to create an unbelievably bright light for a backlight, to create this glow behind us as we whirled around, as we were about to lose our human form and take on this new form and kind of disappear into light. And what they did is they rigged a good-sized disc, and we both, Persis and I both stood on the disc, and the disc kind of turned around slowly. And in order to get this phenomenally bright backlight effect, they used a bulb that from a drive-in movie projector. It was the biggest light bulb they could find. And the bulb, which was only a few feet away from us, was so hot that they had to have huge fans blowing to keep the heat off us, because the bulb threw so much heat that we would have gotten sunburned. And Persis was told, we were both told, to shut our eyes. As soon as the camera was seeing our back, we were told to shut our eyes because the light was so bright that it could sunburn our corneas. And in fact, Persis did, she ignored that and kept her eyes open a little bit for a while, which was a natural thing to do since we were looking at each other. It's hard to remember, oh, I'll close my eyes now. So she kept her eyes open, and she actually got a little burn on her on the lens of her eyes. And if you stood in front of that light without the fans on for about 2 minutes, you'd get a sunburn. I mean, it was amazing. It was just, and you know, all we knew was that we're turning around on a wooden disc with this very hot light and fans blowing, which were blowing our hair, which they wanted, my hair, she didn't have any hair. And it was just the weird, and they thought, okay. And then when you see it in the film, it does look like something magical and mystical is happening. It's quite wonderful. Well, and they were kind of inventing it. I mean, the drive-in, I remember Bob saying, you know what that is? That's a bulb from a drive-in movie theater. I said, why? It's the brightest light they could find. None of the conventional movie lighting equipment would throw a bright enough light. So they went to a drive-in movie projector light.
It wasn't planned in the script from the beginning, but we managed to find the ending anyway. V'ger needed humanity, Decker needed to be needed, Spock needed Kirk, and Kirk needed the Enterprise. The whole point of Star Trek, the motion picture, was to get all of these people where they needed to be, and this ending provided us with a way to do that.
The last night of recording, which was, I remember we finished 2 o'clock Saturday morning, and the picture opened the following Thursday, and at that scene I had recorded the opening Klingon scene, and then the meld scene at the end. And I thought it was really quite good. I was up the whole night before writing it. I think I'd finished it like 11 that morning. And it was like, we finished it, and Bob wasn't still up. He says, I think you do it one more time. I said, Bob, I can't. I don't know what else. And I remember the next day on Saturday, about 4 o'clock, the phone rang, it was Bob. And he says, it works great. Don't worry about it. It works great in the scene.
We've added one new shot which shows the entire V'ger vessel being engulfed just before the final series of effects and the transformation is complete and we see the Enterprise revealed in V'ger's place.
I've always thought, you know, Decker is everywhere. He's everywhere in everything. People say, aren't they ever going to bring Decker back? And I would say, you know, you could bring him back as a lampshade. I mean, he could be anything. He could be an electrical socket or a fire extinguisher. He can be anything. He can take any form. But I like the idea that he's out there. He's in everything. You know, that was the whole deal that he was handed. You can be omnipresent. You can be ubiquitous. You can be all-knowing, all-seeing, all-feeling. So I thought it would be fun to monkey in. But, you know, so far it's never come up. Nobody's ever asked me.
So in the end, despite problems with the script and with the effects, we did stay true to what Star Trek is all about, seeking out new life forms.
Witness the birth. Possibly a next step in our evolution.
I wonder.
Well, it's been a long time since I delivered a baby. And I hope we got this one off to a good start.
I hope so, too. I think we gave it the ability to create its own sense of purpose.
And looking back, I can see that there was no way to make Star Trek without any problems. There were so many people involved in trying to revive it that our goal was simply to get something made and up on the screen. At least we did that to a degree which proved that there was an audience out there. Then it was up to Paramount to take a chance on it, and happily they did. The film was often discussed as being overly expensive. In fact, that's a bit misleading, because from the time Gene Roddenberry came back to Paramount in 1975 to start writing a new Star Trek script, the money spent went on to this movie's tab.
List them as missing.
That included all the writing, design work, screen tests, and set construction that was done for Phase 2, as well as all of the deals with the entire cast of the show. So there was quite a lot spent before I came on to do it as a feature. Then we had to cut our losses with the first special effects outfit, and we began to and had to make sure that Trumbull and Dexter had all the resources they needed to complete their work on time. And that was because we had to deliver the picture for release in December 1979. So altogether, I'd say almost half of the reported budget was spent before we actually started the movie we made. And it did so well financially, but more importantly, it established a franchise that's still going strong. This film changed the way the sets and effects looked and really served as a foundation for all Star Trek that followed. I was delighted to have a chance to go back to Star Trek again after all these years and to work with Mike Matacino and David Fine and on getting the show together and getting it in the kind of original cut that I had wanted always. They've done a fine job for me on the film, and I'm so pleased that they came to me the idea of working on it and getting it back in the original shape.
I guess what I tried to end up with saying with this theme is that these people are adventurers, they're explorers, they're going out in this uncharted territory. I mean, it's no different than, as far as I'm concerned, the outer space is just, you know, instead of going across the deserts and the plains, you're going across the universe, and you end up on some planet in their desert, whatever it is. But you're going to the unknown, which is what 200 years ago they did in this country when they came across. They didn't know what the hell was out there. So there's a sort of an indomitable spirit of these explorers or adventurers, and I think that was what I wanted to try to. I mean, looking back, you know, I had no idea when I'm writing a piece of music what the intellectual implications are. It's a total emotional process with me. If I start thinking what I'm doing, then I get into trouble. It's better that I go with my instincts rather than my head, and that's what I usually do. I know that this score has become sort of a cult thing, and we sold a lot of CDs, and I guess it's still selling records. I think it's for what it is, it's very good. It's one of my favorite scores. The fact that it's had such longevity, that it's still active in the 20 years, it's still in the catalog. The audiences love it when I play it, and as I said, it still sells records, so I guess it's pretty good.
I felt it was an opportunity to put on the screen things that I thought would be beautiful or thought-provoking or beyond the limitations of literal reality. And so the Spock spacewalk, the wormhole, just being in space, seeing the dry dock and all that stuff. And I think that there's a big tendency these days to make movies that are so tightly, hermetically sealed with dialogue that there's no room for the audience to interpret it or say, this is what I saw in it, or I saw God, or that meant something religious to me or something spiritual to me. You know, you got to let movies breathe a little bit. So I got very into that through 2001 and working with Stanley Kubrick and working in, you know, what was then called Cinerama, and and was delivered at that time on huge 90 and 100-foot screens in beautiful non-multiplex theaters. But you'll find that when you can present the audience with an image that's truly worth watching, it's spectacular, it's awesome, it's interesting, there's a lot of things for your eye to look at, you want that moment to be on the screen for a long period of time. You don't want to cut it up into 8-frame chunks. It could be on the screen for 30 seconds, 45 seconds, a minute, uninterrupted. And if it's good, it can hang in there. And whether it's a Stargate or the Mothership or Wormhole or whatever it is, it could be really great. So when I look at a movie like Star Trek The Motion Picture now, after 20 years, I feel like, you know, hey, that's not bad. Because the stuff I'm seeing today is all action-oriented. The cuts are 8 frames long. You never take the time to take a breath and look at something that's awesome and spectacular, awe-inspiring, or, you know, subjective, that gives you an opportunity to kind of grok the fullness of something. I just feel very used by most movies today because they're too fast. They're looking for too much pace. It's very common today that even live action in movies is accelerated by deleting frames. And I just think it's all for effect and it doesn't have any heart to it. You know, this movie has heart. Wacky as it is, imperfect as it is, Star Trek is a very sweet and well-intentioned piece of material.